Hey everybody, welcome to the Snapcast. I'm Bobby.
I'm Alex.
I'm Rob.
I'm Jerry.
So this week we're going to start by talking a little bit about the pre-release, how we felt about the pre-release, the set in general, expeditions, all that fun stuff. And then we're going to take a break and come back to talk about breaking into competitive Magic, just a little bit of how to get out of like the local FNM scene and more into IQs, PPTQs, opens, that kind of stuff. All right, so pre-release. Who all got to pre-release?
I did.
I did as well.
Nice. Yeah, I think it's just all of us but Jerry, right?
Yeah, I didn't, but I did a little bit of drafting on Cockatrice.
Nice.
Oh, there you go.
How'd you guys do? How'd you guys feel about the set? Whichever question you want first.
Fair enough. I did all right. I went 2-2. Could have went 3-1 pretty easy, but just on bad variants and a couple game threes. But, I mean, that's limited.
Yeah, what are you going to do?
Yeah, my pool wasn't the greatest, but I made do with what I had. Some highlights for me was Shambling Vent, really good. The black-white land, put in a lot of work, especially with like Awakened cards and things like that. There's several games. He was a 5-6, a lifelinker, just doing his thing.
Yeah, no, I ended up playing a two-headed giant, and my partner, this was his first sanctioned event, and his 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th game of Magic total. Nice. So that was nice. Fun. Yeah.
So you just like dragged somebody you knew?
Yeah. Well, he showed up. He's like, oh, I want to play Magic. He's like, all right, come on, let's do pre-release. And he ended up playing Control because we pulled 3 Stasis Snares, and a lot of nice. The tap target creature doesn't untap during their next turn. So that was nice, but... Other than that, yeah, nothing big on pulls. Lumbering Falls, I think, was my best one. I didn't even play it. I ran a green-black.
Fair enough.
So, basically, you brought this guy in with you, gave him all the control cards, and said, all right, take care of stuff, and I'll do the work.
Yep.
Nice. That's a pretty good two-headed giant. Yeah, that's pretty good strategy there. Yeah, and for me, like, is Alex and I both went to the same store, and same kind of woes, same laments. Like, my pool was just... It's my classic limited pool that I always get where there's no money and there's also no deck in there.
Yep.
So piece some stuff together. I ended up playing like Esper Flyers kind of deal, kind of control-ish. I mean, it was, I probably could have built it a little bit better. I also found out that I'm too old for midnight pre-releases now. Like, man, I was exhausted all night. Like round 3, I was just like napping on the table. But I mean, but it was fun. I liked it. We had quite a few. We saw quite a few of the expeditions at our shop. Rob, how many did they have over there?
We only had 2. One was a Canopy Vista. The other one was a Temple Garden.
Oh, that's not too
so
bad.
2 green whites.
Yeah, we had 3 at ours, and we had 61 players somewhere around there. So, I mean, I think people are working out to like 180 packs for expeditions.
Yeah. Yep, so that's, you know, it's nice because there's been a lot of, like, darts in the wind and guesses on what the numbers are going to look like. And, yeah, I think across the board so far, 1 in 80 seems like a pretty decent, like, seems pretty true across the board.
Right.
But, I mean, of course, there's excitement for that. And then there's a few, like, walkers and stuff open. Typical, like, pre-release excitement and everything. But let's talk about the set, though. I mean, I don't like it. It's not horrible, but, man, I was kind of bummed out on it. Did you guys experience that at all? Or?
Yeah, I could definitely see it. It was, it's not an aggressive set, and it's setting up to be like big and slow, which is like a lot of limiteds can be because you get to your bomb and win with your bomb. But in this one, like they're bomb uncommons,
right? Yeah, so
like I mean, there were bomb commons in 8-9 Trampler for 8 or however much it was. Yeah. I mean, that's enough of a telltale of what's going to happen in this format.
Yeah, like one of my best cards was Breaker of Armies, an uncommon. There's just a 10-8 that everything has to block. Like,
oh, nice.
Yeah, like it was just, I would play this and then win the next turn because everything else pushes through. But it's just kind of, I don't know. It's kind of a weird spot where there are tempo cards and there are aggressive cards. But as far as Sealed is concerned, it's hard to have like one side or the other.
Yeah,
I think it's definitely a draft set more so than Sealed.
Definitely a draft set. The most successful draft I had, I went 4-0 with a blue-white flyers list because of some of the more powerful blue-white flyers in the usual paltry 3-3 flyer for 5 in this set is now a 4-3 for 5 with Scry 3 attached to it. Mm-hmm. Our 2-3 flyer for 4 now has gain 2 life on it. And on top of that, there was the creature that gives all your lands flying. So now I value awakened spells much higher than everyone else. And it ends up being that I'm pulling all these cheap awakened spells quickly. and early, and I got away with some free wins because no one was prepared to just get hit by a bunch of 3/3 flying lands.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, no, I like it. Yeah, the Awakened spells, like, I liked them so far. I did find myself in the spot where I had the destroy target tap creature Awakened one for 5, I think.
Yeah.
Total. And they just wouldn't attack me. Like, I would be on the upswing. I would have the tempo on my side, so they weren't swinging, so I could never really use the thing. But
right.
But, I mean, like, the Awakened cards seem pretty good. I definitely see where, like, looking through my pool, I can see, all right, here's some pieces for this archetype. Here's some pieces for that. Here's some pieces for that. Nothing, not enough of any given one to build a deck around it. But, like, in draft, I can definitely see it being pretty sweet. Well, at least better. I don't know if I want to go as far as to say pretty sweet. But it's definitely a draft set.
Yeah, we were talking about that, too, a lot at the pre-release. Where, like, I have the sealed pool with, like, some mediocre rares that don't really fit, but my uncommons and commons are good enough that I can pull out some wins. But, like, obviously, if I'm drafting, I wouldn't have those bad rares.
Right.
And, like, I would actually make, like, a decent deck. So I think it's definitely a more draft-heavy set. Like, and that's what Wizards has become with new sets. I think they're more draft-limited-oriented. Like, right. Obviously there's some thought to Constructed and Standard and things like that, but like the more sets, the last couple sets specifically have been very like, oh, this is sweet to draft, but it's kind of, it's interesting, I guess.
Now I have a question involving Sealed. Did they finally get rid of the guild pact thing that they've been doing for the past few blocks?
There's no color. You just get a box of six packs.
So it's now straight six packs. Yeah. Fantastic. So it actually makes more of a skill tester in Sealed then.
Yeah,
well, it was six packs in a promo.
Yeah, right.
Were you allowed to play that promo?
Yeah.
All right. And the promo was it any rare or mythic?
I really don't know. I've heard of promos all over the place. Everything from Omnixilus to Kiora, all the way down to Zeta. You had a couple. Rares. Yeah, so
yeah, because that's what I got. I got Nissa's Renewal, which is just garbage. I didn't even break it from the pack. Like, I'm keeping it in the pack. Maybe it'll be worth 50
pack
cents
fresh,
more.
Boy.
Maybe it'll be 50 cents more or something. I don't know.
Yeah, like, but yeah, I mean, I think that I like that limited format more. I like not messing around with the colors and boxes because, like, it felt like you always ended up having to play other colors, and then your pool was even worse because you had one seeded pack in one color, and then all your packs were in different colors.
Right.
And I like this better. It's a lot more clean. The box and the design, like all the promo stuff they did was pretty cool. They had a little like deck divider in there. I wouldn't shut up about that thing. I always need more of those. So
yeah,
that was very welcomed. I think there's a dice in the box. I never really even.
Yeah, it's down
the bottom.
It's a noise maker. It shakes around.
Keeps me entertained.
Yeah.
It just confused me all night because every time I picked up my box, I'm like, what's bouncing around in here? Like, oh yeah, that die again. But yeah, I mean, so the set though, like I'm interested to see what its effects on standard is going to be, but I'm apprehensive at the same time. I mean, I hope that did they name the next set already? It's
Oath of the Gatewatch.
Yes. The Gatewatch, yeah. So hopefully we'll see some evening out with that because this is a very top heavy set and
yeah.
I don't like the way this is going for standard, but
yeah, I don't think it really has much impact on standard right now. Like, obviously, the planeswalkers are always gonna affect, and like mythics typically affect because their power level is so high. That's where they're mythic and things like that.
Right.
But as far as like the common, uncommon filler that you look for decks, like you know, like the ultimate price cards or your own Devour Flesh, which
hasn't
been around for a while.
Really.
Yeah, like the filler is just not there, in my opinion.
It seems to be the only real common, uncommon filler spell that sees any regular play has been complete disregard as the 3-mana unconditional exile of 3 or less, which is a relevant effect in Constructed right now. But as for anything else, there's just not much.
Right, and that's not even like truly unconditional because it's
right,
3
yeah,
or less.
3
power.
Or less.
Well, I mean, unconditional for the 3 or less.
Yeah,
like, you know, being able to answer a Hangerback or a Deathmist Raptor
in such a way is
fantastic.
And I think the exile effects coming out of the set will be relevant.
Oh, yeah.
But other than that, it's just kind of like, I don't... the power level of the rares are there. I'll give all the rares and mythics in this set are all extremely powerful for the most part. Obviously, there's always junk rares and rares for obviously designed for commander and things like that. But for the most part, I think their power level is there. But just it's in this weird spot where like we're coming off a multicolor set in Dragons, like the clans. We had tricolor lands and focusing on, you know, trying to get tricolor mana for things like Savage Knuckleblade and things like that, right? And Manus Rider, to where like you want good mana on curve, and then now we're going into like a colorless set, and then we get conditional duels that relate to basic lands, but we're still in a multicolor block, so we don't want to run a bunch of basics because we'll be color screwed. So like, I think the two don't work well together, and that's the big problem right now.
Both the blocks are heavily featured on each other's own theme as well. I mean, you're going to be stuck on, if you're playing Dragon Control, now you're in all the cards from Dragons of Tarkir, rather than playing any of the, you know, if there are any control cards that you would like to play in Zendikar, they just don't fit in the Dragon deck because they're taking over spots for, you know, Silumghar Scorn and your Foul Tongue Invocations.
Yeah, and I think moving forward, that's going to be, like when the next set comes out, I think there's going to be even a further divide where it's going to feel like Dragons versus Eldrazi is what I kind of see this going. Like people, you're going to be playing either like Mardu Dragons or Esper Dragon Control versus Eldrazi Ramp and, you know, whatever ally deck shakes out or whatever.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a great point because I think I've been seeing that and haven't really put it to words yet. But yeah, it's like the two sets don't play very well together at all. So, I mean, it's kind of nice in that typically what happens with the new set is you go, okay, this card will be good in this existing deck, and this card will slot right into this existing deck, and there's not really any of that right now. I mean, a little bit, but not a lot. So hopefully we'll see some fresh decks at the Open next weekend using some of the Eldrazi stuff. I definitely want to see a deck with the, what is the Eldrazi Bitter Blossom card, the green one?
Oh, From Beyond?
Yeah, because I really like the 1/1s for the Scions instead of the 0/1s.
Yeah.
Like that made combat pretty interesting, and it made the game pretty interesting, especially because like not a lot of the Eldrazi have trample this go around.
Yeah, there's like one.
Yeah, so you can, I think there might be two, but
that I can remember off the top.
Barely any, yeah, compared to, you know, what you would expect. So like making those little 1/1 guys, the chump block was doing pretty well for me.
Yeah, and it could, it like, and that's kind of the thing where like that's how you beat the ramp style decks, because if like there's a good ramp deck but it's not heavy on trample, then to beat that you just go wide.
Yeah,
so you have like
the board up.
Yeah. So like I said, I think it's going to be one of these things where like Hordling Outburst from Khan's, you know, is going to see more play to like fight off ramp style strategies, where it, once again, it's just going to be a divide in my opinion, where you're not going to mix and match too many cards. I could be completely wrong. Don't hold me to it. But like, let's see. Initial thoughts, that's kind of what it's looking like. And like, I think a lot of the reason people are knocking on this set too is we just came from Ravnica Theros, which worked really well together as two sets. Like the two sets intertwined in decks very well. And then we went to Theros Khan's and, you know, Dragon's Block, which also intertwined very well. They kind of did the same thing, creature based, you know. And then this one is just such a huge divide that it just stands out as kind of like a sore thumb.
It's also, we're getting away from a lot of the, we just had a set of broken cards come out in Treasure Cruise, Dig Through Time,
right?
Tassigar and Jeskai Ascendancy deck.
Yeah.
So now that we don't have any of those obscenely busted cards outside of the Super Synergy and the Mud decks, it's not very enticing for other players.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's the decks. I mean, I like it. I like it in that I feel like Ravnica especially brought a lot of cards that were obvious that they go together.
Yeah.
Like Azorius cards. I mean, but all the guilds really, I mean, it's like, wow, okay, so there's basically a deck here. Let me find, you know, what other slotting cards I want for it. But for the most part, it's pretty clear. I mean, and the Eldrazi ramp deck is pretty obvious. But other than that, like it might just be wishful thinking, but I really think that there is a deck out there that we just haven't thought of yet.
Yeah, for sure.
It's going to pop up maybe next weekend, maybe in a few, but I'm definitely, I mean, you're dead on in that it's a stark contrast between the sets, and we haven't seen that in a while. So it does feel like we've hit a speed bump or something. Something feels jostled, but like, I like it. I think it's good. I think we're going to see a pretty drastic change from here on out.
And it could just be this rough spot where they're changing their rotation of sets, where like the sets are going to work differently and things like that. True. It could just be that rough spot of this is the start of the new standard. So you have to just get over this bump. It could just be that.
Another common theme with, you know, rotation of sets is you're going to wind up, the format always seems to come out as one vice grip control deck of some type and then one hyper aggressive red deck.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of where the formats go to because those are just go to. They're always their decks. So it'll take a little play testing and figuring out from there.
Yeah. And then like, another thing that I think kind of going back to where you mentioned like Azorius and like it works with this, I think that was one of the biggest boosts for like Ravnica Theros was Theros brought Scrylands in right. the guilds. So those fit into like the guilds and like that worked very well. And then like Khans brought the Trilands. So that just helped when you lost the guild stuff. So it helped with mana. And like this one, all the lands don't do that. There's two main lands. There's the conditional duels. And then all the other lands, like they're coming to play tap basics, which is like a little off putting and things like that. Which I mean, Teetering Peaks and all those saw that play in their day in the original. However, they came from a set that wasn't multicolored. So it's kind of putting a hindrance. Like, and the land base is the biggest thing in Magic. Like, it determines what you can play.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But the land bases and all that negatives in this set. I mean, it does with fetch lands. With the conditional duels, we now have perfect mana, essentially, as close as we're going to get to standard.
You can play five color and pretty easy. Like, it's doable. I've already seen, like, the mana basis for it with, like, 25 to 26 lands. You could play five color. But then it comes down to, all right, what do I play in five color? Like, because the sets, once again, the sets don't work. Sets
don't play with each other.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it'll be interesting to see. I the set's kind of growing on me because it's one of those situations where like I don't like the set basically. Like if I'm looking at the cards, I don't like it, but I think it's going to shake things up a lot, and I do like that. So I can kind of be okay with it if I know it's going to jostle everything up. But I'm not really sure what to expect out of standard. That's the biggest thing, and I kind of like it. So. Let's go back to limited a little bit though. Were there any other cards you guys played with that you really just felt were like you had undervalued or you were surprised by?
Actually there's a card I overvalued and that was the blue land. Cause I misread it.
Oh yeah.
I thought it tapped down the creature as well as didn't untapped. And I thought that was sweet. It turns out it just doesn't untap. So that's real bad.
Yeah. Mine was Dominator Drone actually. Ingest turned out to be very, very key. I was very surprised because at first, a couple episodes back, we were talking about Ingest, it's only one card.
It's RNGesus.
Like. Right, but like playing it in sealed, though, it was amazing just seeing what I could rip off. And
it worked well with the put things into graveyard cards as like enablers.
Yeah, I
like
that a lot.
I was running the blue one drop, the blue 1/1 for one Devoid Ingest, and it has when it dies loot. Draw one, discard one.
Oh, okay.
Salvage Drone?
Salvage Drone,
sorry. And then, because the format is a little slower, so people didn't have a lot of, like, one or two drops. So he would hit one or two times for two ingest to just set up my later, you know, anti-ingest, whatever you want to call it.
Right, the regest. I think is what they call it.
Yeah, I think they... It's used on like the processors because there's a different type of Eldrazi. There's like Eldrazi, Scion, and processors. I think it's the processor ability is the put things back into the graveyard.
Oh, that makes sense.
But so like it helped enable that. And then, like I said, it's RNG too. Like there's a couple of times where like I knew my opponent had Desolation Twin because he crushed me with it the game before. Turn one, I hit you with a Salvage Drone, and there goes Desolation Twin, and my matchup just got a lot better. Like it's just things like that that are interesting.
Yeah, like I liked the Scions being 1/1s. That was pretty cool.
Yep.
I had the Black Escape or Retreat to Hagglehelm or something.
Hagra. Yeah, I had it as well. It was pretty good.
Yeah, like I liked that one a lot. I had that and I had kind of like a mini life gain theme going with that. And the Steward, the white one and a white, it's a 2/2. And whenever you gain life, you can pay one white and put a 1/1 counter on something.
Yeah.
And yeah, like I had a few games where I was chaining that together really well, and that felt really powerful. I like that a lot. There might be something there in draft. I don't know if it's powerful enough to keep up with everything else going on, but I could easily see if you got more of those cards, like it could be pretty cool.
It could definitely be a good sub theme and like a... Like, especially if you, like you get drawn to also feed more counters onto stuff. Like, there could definitely be a sub theme there. And that's one of those things like... Because the set hasn't really been drafted yet. It's been sealed. Like, I know, Jerry, you drafted on Cockatrice, but that's not, like, you know, it's not on Modo yet. People haven't gone to FNM and drafted it yet. So, like, it hasn't really truly shaken out of what the good draft archetypes are.
Oh, yeah, no, we're on day zero as far as draft is concerned.
So, like, there definitely could be sub-themes that nobody caught on to that somebody's going to draft it and be like, hey, look at this. It's really good, you know?
Yeah. No, I'm kind of excited to see the... I guess because I was so drawn to the Eldrazi and the more impressive cards of the set that I hadn't even really paid much attention to sort of that life gain thing in there.
Right.
So that was kind of a pleasant surprise because I was building red green at first just because like it was the first natural deck that kind of popped. I had like two bombs in the colors and a colorless one. So I was like, maybe. And then, I wasn't happy with it. So I kind of went back to the drawing board and found this. So I ended up doing Esper and I liked it. It was a fun deck. Now my record was abysmal. It didn't go great, but it was a lot of close games and I had to draw for time. So the deck wasn't crumbling underneath me.
Right.
The one that I was surprised that I liked so much was this Scour from Existence.
Ooh. Oh, the seven drop colorless exile
a permanent.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
Removal is removal.
Right. Yeah. I started with two in the sideboard and then I ended up slotting one into the main after game one and then brought the other one in after like round one ended.
Yeah.
And like that thing is sweet. I like it.
Fair enough. And that's one that got a lot of hate for like people talking about draft. They're like, oh, it's a seven drop. Nobody's going to play it. Like these things are going to table. And that may not be the case. Like,
yeah, well, there's a lot of like the way the power and toughnesses line up in this set is really interesting because there's a lot of times where I could kind of trade and get one of my opponent's creatures. He could trade and get one of mine. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of uneven, like there are very few like straight 5/5 or straight for like things like that. So you had these situations where like, you both kind of got stuck. No one really had a profitable attack.
Mm-hmm.
So you would end up kind of waiting. And like, I never ended the game with a Scour from Existence in my hand I couldn't cast.
Right. Like, yeah. And that's definitely like, cause I started out with 17 lands, which is where I usually like to do in sealed. I ended up going up to 18 just to like ensure that I was hitting land drops and also helping for late landfall triggers, which cause like some of the like good landfall creatures, like I had the Menace one. It's like a 3/2 with Menace and gets +2/+2 on landfall, but it's a 5-drop. So like I want at least another landfall after it and things like that. So I went up more on lands. So that makes Scour better too if you're just naturally going to run 18 lands to help play your 8/8s and 7/7 drops. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I mean, you know, take the advice with a grain of salt because like in draft, obviously, if you're going for a faster build, it's going to be a lot more fleshed out than what you're going to be able to do in limited. So limited's always even slower than draft. But, but I mean, Scour, like I said, I mean, I had one game where I cast it twice and then got to retrieve it with one of the blue Eldrazi and then cast it again. And like, it just felt way overpowered.
Yeah. And actually, another card that I really liked was the Skirmisher. It's in black Devoid. It's an 0/4 flyer. That whenever it attacks, it deals two.
Yes, that was great. I was able to couple that with the Earth and Arms. Gave it +2/+2 for the rest of the game. So swing, lose two life, then take two damage.
Yeah, like I didn't have any pump because I was in blue black for the most part, and even then it was just fine. It's 0/4, so it's a good blocker when it comes down to just block a 3/3 or you know whatever. Like I'm not worried about trading. And the fact that he's a flyer, there's not a whole lot of flying. So having a flying defender essentially is nice. Then he can just get in a cheap shot every now and then for two damage guaranteed. Like it doesn't matter if you have a blocker or not, and he's coming in.
The other one that I liked a lot was the, and I mean it's nothing special in this set, but it's the black flyer with Death Touch.
Right. I mean
that's just always good. But
Death Touch, yeah.
But that worked out well with Scour from Existence too, where I could kind of play him. Well, they could never swing into him because he's gonna die.
Yeah.
They finally decide, like, whatever, I'll swing into it and I just Scour it instead. Like
And I think that's something that this like there's a couple of Death Touchers in this set, and there's the black land that gets one back on top. So I did a couple times where I'm like, oh, I'm just going to play this Death Toucher on defense. When you finally crash in to get through it, I'll block your big thing and then play this black land and get it back next turn. Like,
yeah, no, that's awesome.
You mentioned lands. The entire Blighted cycle of uncommon lands are... I knew they were going to be good. Didn't know how far the mana was going to be able to extend if someone had built the fast landfall deck.
Right.
And I got a hold of two Blighted Cataracts, the blue one that draws you two.
Oh, draws you, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah,
I didn't get any of the Blighted Fins, and if I would have had that, I might have splashed black. But
right.
Just being able to draw too late, get there even further.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's actually one of my favorite cards that I unfortunately didn't have, and I wish I had, and that's Hedron Archive. Like, it's a pseudo reprint. There's one in the last Ravnica. It cost one more and made one more mana and so forth. So this is kind of like a lower to the ground one. But it's an artifact that taps for two to help you ramp, and then you can sack it and draw two cards. Like, it's cards like that that are really nice to have. especially in sealed.
You'll play that in every deck you ever make in any sealed archetype for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I liked the black one drop, 1/1. You can pay 2 to pump them.
Yes.
The Sludge Caller or whatever. Yeah, I had one of those and it was also very good.
Yeah, he was great. There was plenty of times where I was able to trade him up or even just leave him back and not have to, like, they wouldn't swing into it because they knew what was going to happen.
Yeah, like, I definitely had a lot of scenarios where he was free damage where, like, I have up, like, 4 mana and they have a 2/2, so they know I can make it a 3/3, so I just attack. They don't block. They take 1. I play my 4-drop or whatever.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, definitely.
Like, he got in a lot of free damage.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was impressed by him because I almost didn't run him. I'm trying to think if there's any others. Those were kind of the all-stars. The Steward, really, I mean, I built around it slightly, and I benefited from it quite a few times.
Yeah, and that's definitely a build-around card, which you could easily do in draft.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Also, the other thing was I didn't have any, like, I wasn't in those colors, but people around me running the landfall creatures, like, they were really good from what I saw.
Yeah, I played against someone who was able to put together an ally deck,
mm-hmm.
and that was really powerful too. I mean, especially with the double striker one.
Oh yeah,
I mean, he was crashing in for 6 and 8 pretty early on, so that was rough. That was one of my losses. And,
yeah, no, he had a pretty good deck. I know what you're talking about, and yeah, he had like the double striker and the haster.
Yeah,
and like those are just really good. And like I said, those are we talked about them before last time we talked about archetypes. And like I said, the allies are different because it just gives all your creatures, and then if you have another ally, you get benefit.
Bonus.
Yeah.
Bonus.
My problem was for this sealed was the ally I had was the green white rare that requires you to have other allies to tap to give it
that
abilities.
A little harder to work with.
Yeah. Especially in sealed where you just don't have anything.
But yeah, so I mean, overall though, I think it was a good time. I'm still kind of holding out judgment for the set and what it's going to do to Constructed. Just kind of have to wait and see. Do you guys have any last thoughts on this before we get out of this?
No, I think we're good here.
No.
All set? All right, cool. Then we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a minute to talk about breaking into competitive Magic. All right, welcome back, everybody. So for this segment, we want to talk about what, like, making that transition from being a more casual F&M kind of player to a competitive player. I know there's a lot of people who are interested in it, and I know that it can be kind of a daunting first step. I'm also hoping maybe we can touch on some stuff that'll be good for players who have been competitive for a while. So I figure we'll start. Let's go around the room and tell us about what drove you to start playing competitive Magic and sort of what that was like, what your first experience was like with it. Alex, fire it off.
All right, so I've actually stepped up to competitive Magic twice. The first time that I was really competitive was the original Zendikar, funny enough, segue. But so I played then, I drafted a lot then and played Standard. And then Rise of the Eldrazi happened and I quit. I was upset. I was upset in like Standard and like the set and like, and it lined up with things that was going on in my military life, deployments and training and whatnot. So it just timing also. So I'm not really going to get into that. The second time I stepped up now was Theros release. I decided, like, I had free time again. My military stuff obligations were lower, no deployments. So I was like, all right, I'm going to come back to Magic. So, like, I went to, like, 2 F&Ms, and then I went to the Virginia Beach Classic as, like, just straight. I've done competitive 4. I'm just going to jump right back into the mix. So I did the 2 F&Ms at what is now our local game store and had fun, went to the Classic, played a completely different deck, did okay.
Classic Alex style.
Yeah. Last minute, I want to play this instead because it's got more cool cards. Had a good time. And like, I didn't have high expectations for myself. I went 3 for the day. Probably could have done better if I had more time with the deck and had, you know, experience that I made several misplays that I know about now and things like that. But it was really like that starting point of, all right, I came back, I went to like 2 F&Ms, little prep with this deck, and I still went 3. And I was already catching, you know, oh, I could have played this better. I could have done better. And it just re-sparked that competitive nature of myself. And yeah, I'm like, absolutely. I know I can do better than this. And that was just it. Like, I just came back. I'm like, I'm going to do better. And ever since then, I've just constantly strived to get better.
Mine was, so I picked up Magic again during the summer when I moved back up here. I played back in late 1999, 2000 with Invasion and Torment and Judgment. Moved away from the area, got out of it. I didn't know anybody in my new area. And then when I came back, I met back up with Bobby. And he brought up about, hey, you know, they're giving away Magic at Warped Tour. You're kidding. Okay, sure. Let's pick it up. Let's see. And that led to a couple FNMs. And oddly enough, the Virginia Beach Classic. Yeah. That was my first one. I ran Mono Red Aggro. Did very well. I went X and 2. I finished 13th. And I really enjoyed the competitive feel just because your mindset on it was completely different from FNM. Mm-hmm. I liked the challenge. And everybody that you were playing was just at that higher level. And it pushed you to do better. And you started to see that molding of, I need to sequence things better. From round 1 to round 8, I learned so much already just then in competitive Magic. It was outstanding. And I don't regret it one bit. Yeah, it's a drain on the pocket, but it's a good time.
For me, it was my first PTQ I had played. Was my first real competitive event outside of FNMs. I'd been playing FNMs for about 4 months at the time, and we are in the Time Spiral Lorwyn block. And the only deck I had at the time was Elves, and I was working my way slowly into the Fairies list, but I wasn't quite there. But Elves at the time was powerful enough to, you know, you could really run it and get away with it. And I went X and 2, finishing 12th in the PTQ for my first event. And, you know, that was, it was a real uplifter in my spirit, you know, knowing that I can play this game.
Yeah. So going back to the Classic, I mean, and like what Rob was talking about, him and I played a lot when we were younger, and then when he moved, it kind of died down. And yeah, Theros was pretty much when we first, it was a little bit before Theros, around that time period. And man, yeah, we went to a few FNMs, and I just remember, like, I had this like goofy kind of budgety deck that I was playing. That was just something I threw together to kind of check out what the good decks were like. And I just remember playing against one guy that just, like, he was that typical, like, spiky, like, oh, that's cute. You know, that's a cute deck. Like, he kept, you know, calling it cute, and it was just driving me crazy. And that was pretty much the moment where I was like, you know what? Like, I'm done with this. I'm going home. We're looking up some sweet deck lists. I'm ordering some cards. Like, it's on. So we did a few more FNMs like that, and I loved it. And then, yeah, we all kind of went to that, the Virginia Beach Classic, which they don't do classics anymore. That's a shame, man. That'd be nostalgic. But yeah, I mean, my day, it wasn't that great. I ended up dropping, but it was a blast. Like, I had a lot of fun. It was a good time, and, like, it just, like the other guys have touched on, like, the difference between casual play and competitive play is so great. It's just, you're playing a totally different game. You're playing higher stakes. It's just, it's a lot more fun, much bigger rush. I've always been a competitive guy, so that spoke to me a lot, and I was hooked. So, yeah, so, I mean, that's kind of what we want to talk about today, is just, like, making that plunge, because I know that, I mean, Magic's great in that players range from kitchen table making up their own rules to pro tour guys flying around the world to play. And I mean, it's cool that it's the same game at the end of the day, but you can play it in so many different ways and experience in so many different ways. And I think that most competitive players would tell you that, like, I mean, can you guys play casual anymore?
No.
Yeah. No, it just doesn't happen.
Yeah, it's like you cross that bridge and that's that. So let us guide you. We will Sherpa you into the ways of competitive Magic. Do you guys have any solid tips? I mean, what are your thoughts on this? Why should someone go to competitive Magic?
So if you want to go to competitive Magic, you have the desire to win. That alone right there should be enough for you to figure out a way to get into it.
Just competitive nature of, I want to be better than the other guys. You know, I want to, I already know I'm smarter than you, but I want to prove that I'm smarter than you. It's also like to just step up. Just if you're thinking about it, just do it. Go to an IQ. Like, ask ahead of time. You know, at your FNM, talk to the guys that have gone and be like, hey, what should I be prepared for? And we're gonna talk about some of it here in a bit. But just, like, talk to them. Let them guide you. Let us guide you. And then just do it. Just go to an IQ. IQs are small enough. Like, it's FNM plus. And just do it. Experience it. Like, yeah.
I mean, that's really really the biggest thing, is just get out there and do it if you're thinking about it. And if you're kind of leery, go with the group.
Right.
You're more comfortable that way. We've touched it before. Going with a group of other players, they can help critique you on how you did, what you need to do, and different lines of thinking, and it'll help you evolve. We did that with one buddy of ours. We took him down to North Carolina for an IQ. He loved it. He doesn't have the time anymore to do it, and he regrets it, but he said it was one of the greatest things he's done.
Yeah,
it's cool seeing the game from that perspective, because it's casual, it's a fun, have a good time, drink a beer, play Magic, hang out, whatever. But then once you step in the competitive realm, it's metagaming, it's trying to get a key on your opponent, figure out what's in their hand, what they're doing. Like, Magic gets a bad rap, especially for more casual players and outsiders that call it pay to win. And that's really not the case at all. Because once you get to these types of events, you're playing against skilled players who are all running, you know, top of the line lists. They're not, basically budget constraints aren't restricting their decks. It's purely what they think is the best. And when you play it at that level, it's just a different game. It's, you know, relatively what their deck is going to look like. So you know what to expect a little bit out of them. You know what lines you should take on yours. So each time you play a given matchup, each time you play a given opponent, you learn a little bit more about what lines they're prone to take or what they're going to do to get out of situations or like what their trump cards are in certain matchups. So then it just creates this awesome game where you're just sitting there like, okay, well, if he draws this, he can't play it until turn five because it's a five drop. But if he does resolve it, then that's world of hurt for me. So I need to leave this up for that. And I mean, it's just, it's so much more intense. I mean, I think the biggest thing for me that I love about it is that I can have a horrible week at work. I can have a stressful week in my personal life, and I can sit down and like 5 minutes in the first round, it's an intensive enough game that there's no room in my brain for everything else going on in my life. So you kind of finish the day with this like calm, like, okay, yeah, I just kind of purged my brain a little bit. Didn't think about all that other stuff going on and just kind of got wrapped up in the game. Yeah. So that was what keeps me around. Cause I mean, there's definitely been times, and we've all had them, where competitive Magic is time consuming. Like, it is a huge time consumption. It saps everything from your schedule. But I've had times where I have to squeeze in Magic like anywhere I can, and I still always do. Like, if I go a week or two without playing Magic, man, I just feel drained.
just throw a quick like analogy here. The way I think of casual versus competitive is checkers versus chess. Like, yes, there is competitive checkers, but there's only so much you can do in checkers.
Yeah.
And then competitive is chess, because there's so much more. You have to think about more. There's more lines. Like, you just have to be a little bit more knowledgeable. But don't let it intimidate you when you're trying to make that step, because you gain that knowledge by playing.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
absolutely. Magic is very much
learn by doing.
It's a practice rewarding.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Which is funny, because it's weird to think of like, oh, I'm doing, you know, Magic drills. Like, I'm at home doing Magic push-ups. No. But like, you've got to...
Wait, no, I do Magic push-ups.
Oh, okay,
all the time.
Okay.
Yeah. Island. Island.
But...
Does not resolve.
But no, like, you just take reps through your deck and like play games, like proxy up decks and play against them. And like, the more you know matchups going into competitive, or the more you know your own deck, the better it is for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And one issue I've noticed too with a lot of players who have talked to me about competitive Magic, because I have quite a few on my sub, is that, oh, it's expensive. What should I buy? And the biggest thing is there is some research you're going to have to do on your side.
Yeah.
You need to find out what's your play style. Do you want to be aggressive, mid-range, control, combo, if there's combo in the format you're playing? And then just look online. Some people, they give net decking such a black eye.
A stigma. Ugh,
yeah.
Net
it's deck. Like, oh, you're a net decker. But you need it. There are people out there who dedicate their lives far more than any of us ever could to Magic. They've worked the decks out. They know what works well together.
Yeah.
You don't have to copy their 75, but it gives you an idea, especially like mana base. One of the most difficult things to figure out as a junior player is, what should my mana base be? What creatures go well together? The curve, the spells, sideboard. Why do they choose those sideboard cards? So much to go into it that net decking does help you out, but definitely get practice with it.
No, and I agree. I wanted to talk about net decking myself too, because I remember when I first started to come back in Theros and stuff like that, those like first two FMs before the Classic, I was running Black-White Devotion, the black mono-black Devotion adding Obsidat, and I enjoyed it, but I got hated for it. Like, oh, you're a net decker. Oh, just net decking that deck, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, but like, it's good.
It's so good.
Yeah. But I'm winning. What's the problem with this?
Yeah, exactly. So like, then now, like, I think it's hated on less, like, especially at our local game store. Like, nobody ever calls anybody out from decking anymore. I actually now encourage it. Like, somebody's like, oh, I was thinking about trying out that deck. What do you think? I'm like, well, look up the list and see if you like it. Like, or I can look at the list with you and give you my opinions and things. But, like, now I specifically net deck, not even just to know what I should be running, but to know what my opponent could be running. Because the more I know about their deck, the more I know in the matchup. So yep. I think net decking shouldn't get a bad rap at all. No, I think it's encouraged.
And if for some reason you don't care for net decking, you can always look up primers, which are not net decks, but they give you every possible option you could need for any given archetype. And if you can think of a primer, it exists. It's out there.
It's on MTG Salvation.
MTG Salvation. Type in deck type primer. So it'll come up.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I see it with the net deck situation is like, I think about it this way. I want to start racing cars. I'm not going to go out my yard and start building a car. Like, that's never going to work. I'm never there. Companies that make cars, they're way better. You can buy a car and have modifications done to suit your needs, which would be, you know, like taking a 75 and changing 5 or 10 cards. Like, there's nothing wrong with that at all. But like, you're just you're putting yourself into a very deep hole if you're convinced that you're only going to win by building like something original. And I mean, like, there's nothing wrong with that. There are certainly players where that's their thing. Like, that's what they love in Magic, is they can scour through, you know, the junk rare bins and find some combo no one's found and build this amazing new deck. And like, it happens. It's not far-fetched. It's not often, but it happens. But so if that's your thing, like, I don't want anybody to think we're putting them down. If that's your thing, go for it. But there shouldn't be this negative stigma against net decking, because it really is like, you know, you learn from the shoulders of giants. Like, look at people who have been doing this for years and years and years and see what they're coming up with. Try it out. Play it. Like, take the straight 75 and play it and figure out what you don't like about it before you make changes. I mean, that's probably one of my biggest pet peeves, is someone looks at a brand new list and goes, I think I'd do this instead. Like, why? Like, with no reasoning. If you have reasoning, of course, that's fine. But if it's just like, no, I just like this card more. Like, why? Yeah. How does it help any matchup? It makes them all worse. Like, so just take the time, put in the time to get some reps in with the deck and see what you like about it, what you don't. Maybe try a different deck. I mean, proxying is something I wanted to talk about a lot too, because not enough people proxy. Like, we constantly, I mean, we have a box is that your house right now, Alex?
Yeah.
We have a box floating around with just a bunch of proxied up modern decks, and we'll take turns jamming those and against those just to get a feel for them. Like, you can do that with friends all day long and get way better at Magic before you even step into any game shop.
Yeah, like, I have a box in my room with all my Magic cards. That it's an old Fat Pack box, just one half of it. It's completely full of lands and a Sharpie. And I just, whenever I'm feeling frisky and want to see how a deck works, I just pull out a bunch of lands, write out the cards on them, and just sleeve it up and go and see what happens.
Yeah, there's also a sweet site that we use for proxies too. And we'll link that. We'll put that on the page. So if you're not listening on the Snapcast, go over to our page, and on the podcast page, we'll have that link up there. But it's a little bit tricky to use at first, but it prints out nice. Like, you can do white back with just the text.
Yep.
So it doesn't drain your ink a whole bunch, and they look nice and clean, so they're easy to play with. But like, that's a great way to get into competitive. Another great way, if you're worried about costs, is draft.
Yeah.
Like, that's a great way where you can go in. Usually it's 10, 12, 15 bucks, and you can draft and you can learn about the cards. You're going to get better just playing in a limited environment.
Yep.
And then also, you're going to slowly build up a collection. So you've got some trade fodder to get into a competitive deck. I mean, Rob, that's what we were doing at first, right?
Yeah, we drafted so many times. And then finally, we just had enough cards. We went online. There's Magic trade sites.
Yep.
And we just started trading. Next thing I knew, I had Mono Red Devotion, which is what I ran for the Virginia Beach Classic.
Yeah.
You had Mono Black Devotion.
Yeah.
So it was very nice and easy way to do it. And it was fun.
And you learn a lot. Like, that's the biggest thing in Magic, is like, every format teaches you something and makes you better at all the other formats.
Agreed.
So,
and like, you know, going along with budget stuff is like, sometimes you just have to play Mono Red in the beginning. And I'm not going to knock any player for playing Mono Red. And sometimes Mono Red's just good, and I'll play it anyway too. Like, I've run Rabble Red many a time and things like that. So like, there's a time for it. Like, if you're worried about budget constraints, pick up the cheaper deck. That's fine. But then just go to F&M, do well with it, you know,
some of that sweet, sweet prize support.
Yeah, get prize support, get packs, use the packs for trade for what you really want, and just work towards it. And then the same goes into IQs and stuff. Like, there's a lot of times you can just spike an IQ with mono red because nobody was expecting it or something like that. So you can still take a budget deck to an IQ and do fine. And that's even more prize support towards building the deck you want to build.
Yep. Yeah. So, I mean, this is a running theme here, but the biggest thing is if you want to get better at Magic, just play Magic. Like mm-hmm. it really, but you want to, the best thing about moving away from FNM and towards PPTQs and IQs and such is that the quality of player increases substantially.
Yes.
FNMs, I mean, they're great. Like they're perfect for what they are. You're going to get a nice mix of like, you know, four or five spikier players, a few, you know, who have built some crazy deck they've come up with and a few who have no clue what's going on.
Right.
Whereas when you go to these PPTQs and IQs, like it's very rare to see someone hobble in with like whatever they've put together. It's pretty much strictly competitive decks and competitive players. And there's still some range there. There's some that are obviously better than others, but when you're coming up, they're probably all going to be better than you, to be honest. Like when you go to your first PPTQ, you're probably the worst player in the room.
But
and
don't
as
be
you
discouraged.
Do it, yeah, by the time you leave, you're probably the third worst player in the room.
Right.
You know what I mean? And as you go the next week, like, and that's how you walk up the ladder, because like Wizards and Star City Games have done a great job with that. You can start at FNM and work your way up that ladder.
Yep.
Then you could go to PPTQs and work your way up that ladder. I mean, there's a nice system in place where when you feel like you've lost the competitive value in one style of tournament, just move up to the next one. Because like we very rarely FNM at this point because, you know, it's just not, it's, if you're really trying to test, it's not a good environment. You're going to be playing against some off the wall decks and that can be fun. But if you're trying to figure out what your good and bad matchups are and how to play them, that's just not the environment to do it in. So we don't find ourselves there that often. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like you just, there's a competitive place for everyone who wants to play and you just need to find that good starting spot and get at it.
Yeah. I think FNM's like, I'll still go every now and then or like Tuesday night or whatever. But for me, it's repetitions with my deck, like finding the weakness in my deck, or maybe I need to change the sideboard because I did play a deck that I'm going to see and it didn't work out the way I thought it would. Like there's still a little bit of that, but mostly it's just learning the ins and outs of my deck. It is better for me, and that's why I still do some FNM stuff every now and again. And also you get better at reading your opponent, doing things like that, like catching on to his body language of, oh, he slumped the whole time. Oh, he perked up. Crap. All right, here we go.
Yeah.
But like things like that. But then also, it's just, in my opinion, it goes FNM, IQ, Open, PTQ, Grand Prix. That's kind of what I see. And the only reason I put PTQ above an open is because usually the people at the PTQ or PPTQ now are there to win. They're very competitive and it's a smaller tournament like an IQ, but it's more competitive than an IQ in my opinion.
Yeah, I can see that.
So like that's my order of ranking and that's kind of how you work up. And then we'll obviously Pro Tour's top, but you know, that's kind of like the workup in my opinion.
And you can bounce around. Like I would say fully, I mean, we all went to an open before we were really ready to.
Yep,
we had a blast.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, so, you know, it's worth it. Like hop into any competitive scene you want. I mean, you're paying what most of these are $20 entry, 25, whatever it is now.
Yeah.
And it's a day, like just hang out and play. And I mean, all of these, like
it's
all these
cheaper than the movies.
It is cheaper than the movies. And you know, when you go to the movies, you don't get to leave the movies being better at movies. Like,
right.
That's just not
so much good at movieing right now.
Right. I watch movies so good.
I can Fast and Furious so
Lord of the Rings. I saw that in 15 minutes. So good.
Something I want to point out about opens versus IQs or any type of Grand Prix versus PPTQs.
Mm-hmm.
Those are extremely long events. 2 days.
Right.
You're putting in 15 rounds of Magic.
Yeah.
The players that tend to make it day twos and top eights are the players who have the buys, which you obtain via Grand Prix trials, IQs, or just having a certain amount of points that you've earned through Star City.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's another thing.
Buys definitely help for sure.
Buys are the best. You know, getting buys at the lower level tournaments get you through opens much better. Now, that's not to say you don't go 9-0 day one after playing for several years. It has happened before. Players have done it. But it is something to keep in mind and something to strive for. Anything to get you that extra edge in the tournament helps. That extra 2 hours of sleep, man, that is gold.
Yeah,
it's gold.
Yeah.
Solid
it's
gold.
Definitely prevalent in Grand Prix. That's where most people get their two buys, which is, if you go to planeswalkerpoints.com is where you can enter your DCI and check your planeswalker points for these things. If in a year, which they have the dates on there, I believe this one is like June to May, like June of 15 to May of 16, I believe is the this year. But if you earn 2,250 points in that year, you get two buys at a Grand Prix. And luckily that carries over. So like right now I still have two buys at Grand Prix from last year's June to May.
Nice.
So like it, and then like in that I'm earning more points this year to make sure I have it for next year and things like that. So you can get to this point where if you're just playing competitive Magic, because competitive is higher points per win. So you can just get to this point where you're playing competitive Magic, you're going to be locked on buys for Grand Prix. Yeah. And I think Grand Prix is really or nice. I like Grand Prix. Like I'm not going to get too far into that because we're talking about getting into not. But and it's just nice to experience bigger tournaments, like going to an Open where like there's 500 people now. Like it's just a whole different.
Yeah, that was kind of stuff that I was going to bring up too. I'm glad we walked back to it. Is that I think for anybody who's coming into competitive Magic, after you've been playing a little while, maybe done an IQ or two, things like that, go to an Open, like,
yeah,
and play the whole day. Because Magic, like, every tournament cuts to top eight. So prior to that, it's Swiss rounds, and you are not going to get eliminated. You may be playing at table 257,000, but you're not going to get dropped from that tournament.
Right.
So sign up for an Open and just play the whole day one. Like, there's nothing more valuable than getting used to playing 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 rounds.
Yeah.
It's exhausting. It's tiring, but you'll be such a better player for it. Like,
yeah. Like when we first started doing opens and things like that, like 9 rounds was miserable. Like, oh man, 9 rounds, I'm dead. Like round 6, I was like, how many rounds do I have left? But now I'm like, 9 rounds, let's knock it out. Like, let's do this.
Day of Magic.
Yeah. Like there's that mentality shift you also have to get over. And that's, like I said, just like, well, you said, just play the day. Like you could be 0-5, keep playing,
keep going.
Yep. I'm still gonna be happy go lucky excited.
Yeah.
Let me slam some mono red, let's go kids.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, and keep learning each time too. Take notes, whatever it is you have to do to just stay up on it, because all 9 of those rounds, even if you're 1-8, you've learned so much more. You know what you need to do for next time. You know what cards really aren't really working well.
And the thing too, if you keep playing, turns out everyone else is gonna drop. So you're like 1-8, but you're getting paired to like an X2 at that point. Yeah. So like you're still playing good people.
Crush dreams.
Yeah. No, you're going to get paired to still decent players that are also doing the same thing you are and just grinding out for experience. And that kind of takes some pressure off too. Like, yeah, if you have a bad day and you're like X4, but you're still playing because your friends and stuff are, those games
bonus rounds.
Yeah, like call them. They're a little bit looser, but it's still good to keep playing. And it kind of takes the stress off at the end of the day, kind of thing. And like, it's good, a good habit to get into, in my opinion.
There was actually you mentioned doing bad throughout a day. One of the stores down on the south side of the water, they did where you would play through the entire. You played through the entire IQ, played every round, and they would give you a pack of the current set for each win you had per match.
Right.
So, you know, you went 3-3. I didn't top 8, whatever, but I got 3 booster packs. That's kind of nice. Yeah. You make out with a lot of money.
Yeah,
not every store does that, but, you know, some places offer that.
Yeah. I know other stores definitely do the pack per win or things like those kind of tournaments that are just also good experiences to have.
I would say one thing too is, just because it's your first like competitive tournament, don't be discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can win at these. If you look at the top 8 deck list from all the super IQs, elite IQs, opens, it's not the same 8 people week to week. It's not always Brian Braun doing Chris Van Meter, Brad Nelson and that taken in the top spots. No, sometimes you see them go 0-3 drop.
Yeah. Well, and usually like out of the top 8, it's usually like 4 pros and 4 like, you know, good players, but just that you've never heard their names before. I mean, that happens all the time. But yeah, I mean, there are bad beats and days happen, but don't let that discourage you. Like, you always have to remember that, like, a record at any given tournament is not how good you are at Magic. It's more of your portfolio, your overall experiences, because we all have 0-2 drop days. It happens.
Another thing I want to touch on here is the Magic is a community. Like, we all look out for each other and like, use this resource. If you're a new player trying to get into competitive, talk to these guys, get information from them. But also, if you're worried about budget or like you're missing cards or whatever, ask to borrow cards. Yeah. Like, just ask. Like, if I've met you like once or twice, I might need collateral from you. But I'll let you borrow cards, because guess what? You're gonna play in the same tournament, so it's better prize support, or you know, things like that. Or it's just you play now, you win, you get some prizes, you get the deck you want, you don't have to borrow these cards, and it makes you a better player too. Like, I'm willing to support people to help them be better too.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up, because this is something that I'm shocked we haven't touched on yet. But mm-hmm. when you're a newer player coming in, don't be intimidated by all the current players. Mm-hmm. Like, even at FNMs, even at bigger tournaments, like, a lot of Magic players are introverts. They keep to themselves.
Yep.
Find the guys who are goofing off and laughing and just go stand in that general area. And before you know it, you've made new friends. Like,
yeah.
Don't let that, because I know that's a big hindrance for a lot of people coming in, is like, it feels like an old guys club. Everybody knows each other. I don't know anybody. But like, in the blink of an eye, you're right there in there with everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, you and me met at the Virginia Beach Classic. I beat you in a round, and then we hung out afterwards. And like, what do you know? Here we are.
Yeah. Like, stupid Blood Baron.
Shouldn't play Mono Black Devotion.
Blood Baron, Scooze, Arbor, Colossus, what are you doing?
I'm winning. I'm winning. That's what I was doing.
Yep, that was a rough day. Speaking of rough days, yeah. But yeah, so I mean, just take everything from this, let it pop around in your head for a while, and just go do it. Like, it's a good time. It's a blast. You become a much more competitive player way faster than you would expect. Like, and like, I'm jealous of newer players, because that's when you like, you gain so much knowledge and you get so much better. Like, each time you play Magic, like, just learn shuffling your deck, you get better.
Yeah, like the knowledge curve is definitely like a peak. It's like you're learning so much. And now we're like, man, what did I learn today? I learned I suck at Magic.
Yeah, like, yeah. Like, don't play this deck, I guess. Like, I don't know what I got.
It's something a guy had learned from me, not to boost my own ego, but mm-hmm. I had
here we go.
Oh, God. You know, I've been doing
your head's big enough, Jerry.
I've been doing a pile shuffles of seven. Yeah. And the statistical theory is you shuffle a deck seven times, the deck is sufficiently shuffled.
Yeah.
The person asked me why I was doing this, and I explained it to him. Yeah. Ever since he picked up on it, started doing it, and he's like, my draws have been so much better. My game's gotten better. It's just every little thing like that starts to pick up.
So you taught a guy that he should shuffle his deck.
Pretty much, but hey, there's a right way to shuffle, there's a wrong way to shuffle, there's insufficient shuffling, there's ways to just do it wrong.
All right, so guys, come back next week for Shuffling with Jerry. It's going to be hard to do an all-audio lesson on shuffling.
You just hear riffling in the background.
All right, guys, that was a proper shuffle. Did you get that?
All right. Don't do it like that. All right, but yeah, I mean, we're coming up on time here. So is there any last tidbits, any golden advice you guys got left that you want to give before we go?
Like I've been saying, just reach out to people. It's a community. Reach out, man. Just talk to people.
My piece of advice for y'all is, if you want to play in competitive Magic in a given format, pick a deck and stick with it. Learn it, the ins and outs, all its matchups. Don't flop between decks. Don't do so many audibles.
Good point.
Don't be honed in on just high dollar cards, because like we're talking with the budget decks. I mean, those competitive decks are $90 tops for all 75. So just because a card is $40 doesn't mean it needs to go into your deck.
Nice. Yeah. And my biggest one would be, leave your ego at home when you're getting into it, and even when you're the best player in the world. Like, don't walk in with any presumptions about how good you are. Go in knowing that you know nothing, and you'll learn way more that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go. With all of this, I think you guys would be good. And like, we're always available. Add us on Facebook, add the Snapcast, leave us comments on our page. If you guys have any questions, need any help, like, feel free to reach out. So yeah, that's going to do it for us this week. Speaking of our website and feedback, we've decided we're going to run a little contest. So what we want people to do is to go out to the page, like always, and leave us some feedback. We want things about the site you don't like, things about the cast you don't like, things you like are good to hear too. But mostly we want to make sure that we're shaping this into something everybody wants to listen to each week. And we want to make sure you get the most value out of it. So anything you've got, leave it on there. And what we're going to do is, for episode 10, we'll announce some winners, and we're going to give out some packs of Battle for Zendikar. So we're going to do like three people, probably do like 4 2-and-2 packs, and we'll send those out to you. So leave some feedback, leave us your email address in there so we can get a hold of you. And like I said, we'll announce those for episode 10, and we may be announcing some additional ways to get some entries over the next episode or two. Also, check out the website. Like I said, leave some feedback. We have the Facebook page up and running, so if that's the easiest way for you to follow it, definitely check that out. And talk to you next week.
Oh, snap.